With us now is Jeremy Allison from Google, who's also a Zamba team member. And we will hear something about new features in Zamba 3.2. It's all yours, have fun.
All right, thank you very much. So what I'm going to talk about, I say new features in Zamba 3.2. I think Volker has a very similarly named talk later on this afternoon. So really, these aren't just the new features in Zamba 3.2, because Zamba 3.2 has had an enormous amount of development effort, as you may have noticed, by the fact that the gestation time for it is longer than that of an elephant. We were actually planning to get it out by the conference, but we've got some last minute bugs as usual, so we want to make sure that the release is at least a reasonable quality. So these are the things that I did, basically. These are the industry new features that I did for Zamba 3.2, because there's been a quite amount of new code done. Now, this, as you may have noticed, Volker's done a bunch of stuff. Gunther's done an amazing amount of stuff, doing RPC buffers. Simo, Michael, everybody's put a lot of code into this thing. It's been a massive refactoring effort. So the things that I'm going to cover today are the removal of the static buffers, why we did it, what effects it will have. And then there's some interesting packaging issues that I'm hoping, if there are OEMs or vendors in the room, that you'll be aware of for when you actually package and ship 3.2. A cool new feature that I actually added mainly at the request of Steve French, and it was just one of those cool things that we could do. And I was intending to go up to Redmond, Washington in the US, and present this new feature to Microsoft. Unfortunately, I came down with pneumonia the week before, and so had to miss my trip. But I'm hoping to go up there in June and talk with the Microsoft folks about doing SMB encryption, how we've done it in SMB1. You know, maybe if they have an idle engineer's time, they can do the same for SMB1. But probably, more realistically, talking about how we can do this in SMB2. Then there's the IPv6 conversion, which I believe David Holder has already talked about. And then there's some interesting performance features that we did specifically for an OEM vendor who found this was a performance improvement, but they had a very specific patch. So what I did for 3.2 was I made this more general, and it was another. I also added another feature from Steve French for the Linux SIFS client. So death to p-strings. Has anyone looked at? Oh, by the way, please feel free to stick your hand up. Tell me I'm wrong. You know, I know the Zamba team members and others in this room are not shy, so please just, you know, interrupt and tell me I'm an idiot. So has anyone looked at the Zamba code and run across the infamous p-string? Anyone? Yeah, just wondering whether anyone else. So p-strings suck. They've been in the Zamba code probably since, I think since the very first version that Andrew created, the NB server code. And it's a convenient fiction for a path length. It's been there forever. It's basically a static 1024 byte buffer. And it was like, okay, how long is a piece of string? How long is a path name? Well, 1024 bytes, that's kind of enough, that's kind of useful. And so that's what we used. Now the problem is this thing bled through everywhere. Once you've got a convenient fictional abstraction, even if it's wrong, it's convenient. And so that's the problem with it. So you ended up with p-strings absolutely everywhere, even in places that weren't path names. Sort of like, oh, I need a fixed size thing. I know what, 1024 bytes is okay. Let me just use p-string.
It's enough for everyone.
Yes, 64K is enough for everyone, and 1024 bytes, hey, that's enough for any path name. And the other thing was, it's actually very efficient, because in many of the Zamba code paths, you just push a bunch of p-strings on the stack. There's no allocation. You just push the stack pointer down. When you're done, you pop the stack, and they're gone. So, like I say, they were used a lot of places. So why must they die? Well, they really don't fit inside the modern world. 1024 bytes was a reasonable maximum path, and in fact, most people running Zamba 3.0 don't even notice that there is that limit, but some people do. The world has gotten more complicated, and I've had two users now reporting errors with applications that are coming back with Samba's failing because the paths are too long. Now, you know, the people ended up modifying the apps, getting a shorter directory path, but that's a bad sign. The other thing is, of course, internationalization. You know, being originally a Brit and now an American, of course, I have the usual sort of English complete myopia. Why doesn't everybody just use ASCII? But yes, indeed. But my son, who will be speaking Chinese, will probably complain. So the thing about we ended up moving to UTF-8 encoding in Samba to handle internationalization. And UTF-8 encodings can be up to 6 bytes per character. And let's say you've got a large path name using 6-byte UTF-8 strings, you've only got 170 characters. That's not a long path name. The people who complained were actually US users, but possibly because people in Asia are very polite, they're suffering and just not saying anything. So, as I often do, I love the title of this slide, blame Volker. Most of the things that go wrong and go right in Samba can come down to Mr. Landecki over there. So Volker basically started this by trying to get rid of a lot of static and fixed buffer sizes in many of the receive and reply packet code paths. And so he kind of did a bunch of refactoring that I'm sure he's going to talk about later on today. Got a wonderful request-reply structure set up, so we're moving into the modern age. And then he said, yeah, but we've still got those static fixed P strings, and you go fix that. So I thought, oh, well, how hard can it be? You know, there's not that many of them. And then I found all the other places in the code where they were being used. And also there were many places where utility functions were being called that didn't actually understand what was being passed to them. So, you know, they were called as though they were taking a char star with a potentially infinite buffer size or modifiable buffer size, and they were being called with a P string. And basically these are bugs waiting to happen. These are, you know, so we decided the only safe, in the end I decided, look, what I've got to do is just get rid of P strings out of the code base completely. So, as I said, at that point, Volker said, oh, yes, that's a good idea. Why don't you go do it? So my initial test was to say, well, what happens, how much breaks if I remove the P string data type? Let me just see the scope of the problem. And it was just impossible. I was like, oh no, nothing compiles anymore. Every single module failed. So pstring was used, I just checked in Samba 3.0, it was used in, you know, about 1,500 places in the code. And in some ways, in very complicated ways, strings being constructed into a static buffer size. So as usual, you end up sort of repairing the house in stages. First, I'm going to fix the walls, and I'm going to fix the roof. And so what I actually did was sort of started with the utility functions. And as usual, what you do is you end up having duplicate functions. You leave the pstring functions in place, and you build a separate scaffolding of framework around outside of it. And then eventually, you remove the inside of the house, and then nobody notices that you're living in a bigger house, and they didn't kind of notice. This actually took quite a while. But it's done, and I finally got rid of the pstring data type, which was quite fun. I'll show you the commit message a little later. One of the effects of this was quite interesting. Samba got slower, which is not something that you really want. And what it turns out is that when you're not having these very efficient pushes and pops of pstrings on the stack, and you're doing talloc, actually was mainly what we used to for hierarchical memory management. What we discovered is essentially malloc became an important factor in our performance, which it wasn't before. If you actually do valgrind, cache grind tests on 3.0, malloc isn't a very high function in the number of operations. In 3.2, malloc is very important. Malloc matters. So we actually had some issues with talloc, with small requests, and Volker came up with an actually genius piece of code to fix that, but I'm going to let him describe that, called talloc pools a little bit later on. And that really helped. But what it really came down to in the end is that malloc needed to get faster. So I grubbed around on the net, and my employer, Google, had just released under a BSD style of license something they call TC Malloc. I can't actually remember what the TC stands for, threads something, maybe. And it's very, very fast. It's much, much faster than the glibc malloc. And it turns out that you linking with that, I'm going to throw out an arbitrary number here, but because it's very hard to do without proper formal testing, which we are planning to do in some of the large vendors' labs. But around, say, 10%, you get 10% performance back. But that matters. I mean, that's a significant amount. And so what I would recommend is that for initial ships of Samba 3 on, you know, SUSE and Ubuntu and Red Hat, that you make it dependent on the Google TC malloc. And you actually, it's very simple to use. TC malloc is simply a malloc replacement. All you do when you link Samba is you add minus L TC malloc to the link line, you know, before the rest of the libraries. Before libc, and it uses TC malloc instead. So if you can make that dependent so that that gets pulled in with a Samba package when people download, that would be very, very good indeed. TC malloc's portable, it should work on any POSIX system out there. So of course, you know, I was telling Tridge about this, and Tridge said, well, I've looked at TC malloc and it's kind of good, but I think I know a better way to do that. And so this being Tridge, about 1,000 lines of code later, he had something called Alloc Mmap. And we benchmarked that, and it beats the crap out of Google TC malloc in the non-thread safe case. It's actually unbelievably fast. It is the fastest malloc instance that I've ever seen, which is, well, it's Tridge code. Understanding it, that's a different matter, but it's very, very fast. The only issue is with it is that if you're running in a threaded environment, he's made it thread safe now. If you download it from his junk code directory, it's thread safe. When you turn on the thread safety, it's just a hair slower than the Google one. So anyway, it's worth doing some experimentation there. It is possible that we will merge that code into Samba and basically use macro trickery to make sure that all our mallocs call Google, call Tridge's malloc. The issue is that the reason why we usually have to pull in pthread libraries is that very often we link with LDAP, and the LDAP libraries, A, suck, and B, are threaded and pull in all the thread primitives. I think the issue with the LDAP libraries, I was testing this when I was at Novell, and they just linking with the LDAP libraries increases your stack space by 8 meg because they decide to be very generous with themselves when they're doing LDAP calls. But anyway, so without that, Tridge's malloc is definitely the fastest. So here was my... this is what happens when a major component is retired in Samba. And I'm always very fond of ASCII art. So there's the requiem for... Well, yes, I think Tim Potter started doing this. He's very creative. The very first one of these was when we first started doing the NT status codes, Jean-Francois Michelot, an early Samba team member, used kind of a joke, NT status no problemo for NT status OK. And it was kind of fun for a while, but when you got 10,000 instances of NT status and no problemo, even cut and paste got tiresome, so we replaced it with NT status OK, and I think Tim created one of those for... So we got rid of it, God, was it last year? Anyway, I say this thing has been gestating a long time. The final left as an exercise for the reader, because I do intend to do this, but just not right now. We still have one sucky data type left, which is f-strings. I can't even remember what the f stood for. It did file, I think, a single file. Yeah, so that was supposed to be a single file name component. Those things have also been around as long as p-strings. They're 256 bytes, so they're not as bad. And of course, the problem with f-strings is they're used in a million places that have nothing to do with file names, and eventually someone's going to have to go in and do the same thing I did with p-strings, but that's not critical, and it's probably something we'll get to over the next year or so. So, SMB level encryption, woohoo, new feature, something Microsoft doesn't have yet, yay! And this was Steve, because Steve's a bit of a sort of, I like this idea, we can, you know, Steve and I bounce ideas off each other. So SMB does signing, but it doesn't do encryption of the data, the actual data transport. So we have an extension space inside SMB for the Unix extensions. And so Steve and I started brainstorming about putting encryption into the packet stream. So we had some constraints on this. We can only work within the Unix extension space. We can't change any of the standard SMB calls. We can't add new flags. Hang on a second. We can't add new flags to the headers. So anyway, yes, question from Andrew. So Andrew, yeah, Volker, please don't teach me how to give presentations. So Andrew's question was, are we sure that we have the Unix extension space carved out and safety from Microsoft? Is it in the published protocol documentation? Actually, I don't. Well, the SNEAR document for SMB did mention the Unix extensions. I don't believe the Microsoft document does. I haven't gone and specifically looked. I have them on this laptop. We could check. I believe that the SNEAR document is referenced in the Microsoft specs. And so even though the specific Unix extensions aren't mentioned in the Microsoft docs, I believe the reference should be enough to safeguard us. With hopefully people from Microsoft, I don't know if anyone from Microsoft's in the talk, I don't see anyone, but, I believe because it's like one or two opcodes in the Trans2 space. It's not a new SMB opcode. So I think we're almost certainly completely safe on that. And what I'm hoping to do is to work with the people at Microsoft to see if we can add some of these opcodes in a reasonable way into SMB2 as well, so that we get the same level of features. So the other thing that I really needed it for was so Google uses NFS internally, and they use Kerberized NFS, and my goal is to replace that with SIFS, that's one of my private goals, is to replace that with SIFS. And of course, if they have it, we have to have that too. So we have to have an encrypted transport, because NFS does, and hey, you know, it's keeping up with the Joneses. So what's the right way to do this? Well, you don't want to perturb any of the SMB calls themselves. The goal is you turn on the encryption and all of the upper layers don't have to know it's there. And some of the early code messed that up badly. but it ended up being refactored, because this is fun work, right? You know, this is recreational coding, essentially. You know, it's a feature that nobody needs, that nobody's expecting. It's just something nice to get done. So you can take your time and get it right. So my first thought was, well, if you've got SMB encryption, which includes signing, then you certainly don't need, if you've got encryption at that layer, you don't need the signing at the SMB layer. But eventually I thought, no, I'm not going to mess with layering violations. After some initial experiments, I just thought, okay, leave SMB signing alone. If SMB signing is negotiated, the packet is signed, and then the packet is encrypted underneath, encrypted and signed using a different mechanism. So it's kind of a redundancy there, but it's just a lot easier to separate the layers that way. The other thing I didn't want to do is I didn't want to try and invent my own encryption methods, because we'd mess it up, and we'd end up on the front page of, you know, security news, morons try and invent their own encryption standard, that kind of thing. So I just wanted to use completely standard-based encryption. And I also, I mean, for a thought for the future, I really wanted to make it easy for Microsoft to implement this if they chose to do so. So what I chose was the GSS API framing, which is identical. And Andrew was very helpful in getting me to do this. GSS API framing, which is the same as the SSPI framing that Microsoft used. So what I really wanted to do was to get it to the point where when I'm showing Microsoft this, I can say, hey, you guys already have the kernel call for this. You just have to, you know, stick it in. The other thing that Steve pushed for, I wasn't sure was required, but I think he's right, is he wanted to be able to have an SMB server that had a multiple of shares, some of which were marked encrypt only. So in other words, you can do a TCON and connect to those shares, but any operation on them fails with access denied unless you negotiate transport encryption after that connection. So that's really handy. So you can have a bunch of shares, some of which are public access and some of which are encrypt only, and you know the data transferred from them is always secure. And the other thing I wanted to do was, I'm using GSS API, SSPI framing, which is usually used with Kerberos, but I really didn't want to have home users to have to set up an AD controller with a Kerberos, you know, with a Kerberos KDC. So I wanted to make this work with LANMAN encryption. And admittedly, that's not amazingly secure, but it's good enough for home business networks. So standard SMB packets start with FFSMB. So obviously, if you're going to have an encrypted packet, that's got to change. You've got to be able to recognize an encrypted packet. Because the other goal was, not the only thing that's visible, you see the length, the 4-byte length field, and then you see the 4 bytes of packet, the packet header identifying the packet type, and then everything after that should be encrypted. That's the goal. So encrypted packets start with FF and then an E for encrypted message block. And then after that, there's a 2-byte little endian encryption context ID. So the idea was that a client could set up multiple encryption contexts, and the server would, for each encryption context you set up, the server could return back a token, which is just a 16-bit ID. And then when the server recognizes an incoming packet, it looks up the encryption state based on that token. The SAMBA 3.2 implementation doesn't do this yet, and so the server always returns a context of zero. Now, it actually turns out that, you know, this doesn't matter because it's completely client-driven. The client asks for a token, for an encryption context, and it looks at the 2 bytes that it gets back. And so the idea is a client, the goal is to be able to support multiple encryption contexts, but you don't have to, and a client that supported multiple encryption contexts would still work with the server that didn't. Because if the server always returns zero, all that happens is you're essentially rekeying your same client state. So each encryption state is indexed by those 2 bytes. The other thing is, it actually turns out in an enterprise environment that it's a very bad idea to have more than one encryption context for a security hole reason. And I'll actually go into why that is in later on in the talk. So essentially the way it's layered in SAMBA is that you create the packet right down at the point where you're going to stuff this thing over the wire. If encryption has been turned on the connection struct, we just call into GSS wrap, GSS unwrap, or because they're not, that they don't use NTLM encryption in many of the Unix libraries, we have our own equivalents that do SSPI, GSS API framing. And, you know, this is going to be slow because essentially at this layer, packet lengths can change, which sucks, you know, because SSPI framing can add padding or whatever, GSS can add padding. So, you know, you're going to have to do a malloc and a memcopy. But hey, you don't use encryption if you want performance, right? Because you already suck. So as I said, no changes to session setup were allowed. So we had to tunnel this within the trans2 changes. And the Tridge found the changes we made so offensive. This is behind his wonderful comment of, hey, let's just put some more lipstick on this pig. he thought it was such an ugly way of doing it, you know, rather than inventing a new protocol, but which was going to be the title of my talk about, well, which hopefully still will be the title of my talk about Microsoft. Let's put some more lipstick on this pig. So the way it works is you do a tree connection X to the share, and you do a query file system info Unix extensions, and we have a new couple of capability bits. One of which says I'm capable of doing encryption on this share, and the second capability bit says you must do encryption on this share. And then the client then calls a trans2 set file system info with a Unix extension info level saying request transport encryption. And essentially all you do is you pass a blob of data at that point, and the blob of data is almost well, it is the same data, because I reuse the internal routines in Samba, that you would use to do the Espinego negotiation, security negotiation on a session setup. And then the client returns a blob, and you keep doing the round robin trips, doing set of S info reply with the blobs until you get an okay back and the security negotiation is finished, or you get an access denied. So I would say you keep doing replies there. Yes, question.
Why didn't you inherit all the security context and what you'd already just done 2 packets ago in the session setup?
So the question is, why don't you use the same security context for the session setup? The reason for that is actually, I did think about that. The reason for that is actually the security hole that I will come into, go on to in a little while. It's actually a very bad idea to do that, especially for a kernel-level client implementation. So the idea is you can session, you could theoretically do a session setup anonymously and then session setup an encryption context afterwards. You would still get anonymous access, but the packet data would be encrypted using the context that you'd negotiated via the trans2. And that turns out to be important, mainly because you want to use machine account credentials, and I will explain why. So the final reply is unencrypted, and then as the final parameter block that comes back, it gives the client the 16-bit encryption context to use basically in the next packet for the encrypted request. So once you've set that up and negotiated that up, any client requests that the connection is marked as an encrypted connection, and any client requests coming in must be encrypted or the server will reject it. So the way it works for a mandatory encrypted share is if a client doesn't support that, it does the TCONX. Because the server is the share is marked mandatorily encrypted, the only unencrypted packets that we will allow through are QFS info and setfs info with particular info levels. And so you can actually rekey at any time, because essentially it's an encrypted data stream. The server doesn't care if you're worried about long-term session key expiry, or someone sniffing too many packets. You can just, the client has the option to rekey at any time. I did think about putting an option in of having a specific error message that the server can return saying, hey, it's time to rekey, but I thought it was probably easier to just leave the client to make that decision. Kind of a cop-out. So for user space implementations, so here's the security issue. If you are doing a user space implementation like, say, libSMB client in Nautilus or SMB client command line tool, what happens is it actually reuses the session setup credentials. Now, it doesn't do that on the server. What I'm saying is the client reuses the client password hash to renegotiate the encrypted connection credentials. SMB client is an example of this, and I will show that in a demo in a few minutes. Now, this is the big issue. That a couple of years ago, one of the Heimdall guys who was here actually sat me down in that restaurant over there and said, this sucks, you can't do this, and this is why. And the issue is buffer cache poisoning. So when you have a kernel implementation, the data being returned into the path name data being returned from the server essentially is trusted. So admittedly, you have to trust the server, but it is possible for a server to send back essentially bogus path names. And for most client implementations, they would go straight into the buffer cache without any security checks that the server has the rights to actually access, to actually enter something in the buffer cache under that name. So what could happen? Let's say you don't own the server, but you can do a man-in-the-middle attack because you know your own password. And because you know your own password, you can decrypt any of the traffic that's gone on the wire. So what you would do is you would have a man-in-the-middle attack, and then once you've got an encrypted connection, you would insert a bogus path name that can then be stored in the buffer cache, say, etc. shadow or whatever. And because you're doing it on your own, because the encryption context is set up using your password, you have the ability to do that. So for internal implementations, you have to use the machine account, because the machine account password, because no user knows it. So at that point, you are immune from buffer cache poisoning. Because if you know the machine account, it's game over anyway, right? You know, you have access to the domain. But as a regular user, that data can't be encrypted using the user's password, because at that point, the user can insert stuff into the stream, and you don't want them to do that. Yeah? Yes. 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 I mean, that's another. Yeah. Yes. I agree. It's a lot easier to do this in user space, essentially, because once things get into the kernel, they tend to be trusted, and so that's. Yeah, Simo. Well, the issue with that is I wanted to use standard GSS API framing. And there's no way to have different signing credentials and sealing credentials. So, that's theoretically doable. It would just be a horrible nightmare to program up. And you would end up with this messy implementation of GSS API. Yeah?
To work around this, would you have not simply done a session setup first as the machine account, set up the crypto context, then session setup a second time as the user? And that way you can inherit the context as we've discussed. But the user still gets their access
and then
the user
will do. I'm sorry? That's what I told you. So the question is, you could do an initial connection session setup and then inherit. Let's chat about that offline. That's theoretically...
just for the recording. So what I was suggesting is that rather than coming up with a second complete session setup and things for doing the crypto, that you use inheriting of the crypto context from your session setup that you start with. But because of your problem with security, you first do a session setup as the machine account, okay. And then you come back as the user and do a second session setup, but this one doesn't do the encryption. And so therefore it's still encrypted with the first one, but user access and things is under the user account.
Okay, working out sort of layering and how to inherit and when to inherit gets a little trickier.
No, it's just the same as SMB signing. First one wins.
Yes,
yeah, but how do you do the rekeying then?
That's right. You can't do rekeying. There's some issues with that. We should take this offline. Mm. But essentially, this actually works quite well. And if you choose the machine account credentials on the second setup, then at that point, you can be guaranteed that you don't get that problem. And I thought this was the other way, essentially, programmers have to understand too much about the crypto to make this work. And I wanted to make it reasonably easy to use. And hopefully I'll be able to show you that. Yeah. So, yes.
The other one is, we have separation of concerns here.
Uh-huh.
So the encryption setup should be a separate call. That might be the counter argument.
Yes, so Volker's comment was an encryption setup for an encrypted share probably should be a separate call, essentially, to logically separate the action of setting up an encryption context. To be honest, that was a more comfortable... Doing a separate crypto setup for the T-Connex was a more comfortable... I just felt it was a better design. It was a more comfortable design. It made more logical sense. Anyway, so I'm going to give you a small demo, and as I said, please don't crash. So I've just run SMBD. Hopefully that's large enough to see. And if I can show you my samba-lib-smb.conf. You can see that there's nothing fancy in the global section. I have two shares, temp, which is just a standard share, and then temp encrypted, which has SME encrypt equals mandatory or required or whatever. Now, for temp, there's basically a silent parameter of SME encrypt equals auto. So you can negotiate encryption on the temp, it's just not mandatory. So
What's the default?
The default is auto. So the question is, what's the default? The default on a share is auto. So encryption is supported if you set it up. It's just not required. So if we start a Wireshark trace, and let's just sudo, let's just capture everything on port 445, and it's going to whine that it's not promiscuous, I don't care. Okay, so if I do a, let me get to the source, git, source, I do bin smb client, connect to localhost temp. First I'm just going to show you username DRA test. So this is the standard, Jerry is my, so it's Jeremy test, okay. So there we are, just a standard non-encrypted SMB connection. And if you look at it, there we are, the usual. Just to prove I have nothing up my sleeve, there's the non-encrypted connection, okay? So let's stop that and start again. Now let's do this and add.
It has complained about
thank you. So the magic minus E option for an encrypted request. And there you go. Exactly the same data coming back. But look at the Wireshark trace. Session messages. Okay, so let me do a stop. Just killed it. Sorry about that. I hit restart instead of stop. I'm going to have to do that quick trace again. I want to show you the... saving. Okay. LS. There we go. So we stop. Now, if we look at the packet traces, here we see the standard NTLM session setup, the TCON, the QFS info for the Unix parameters, setFS info. Here we have the key exchange. Wireshark reports it as a FS quota, as there. So it doesn't have support for this yet. Then after that, let's actually take a look at the packet. So it just says NetBIOS session service, length of 116, and here's the data. So here's the FE encryption context, start of the SBNAGO framing length, then everything else is encrypted. So it's essentially the same as encrypted RPC, but for file transport. And as you notice, there's no unencrypted message now on this share. Yes, question.
So when's Ronnie going to end the decryption support?
Question is, when is Wireshark going to support this? Don't know. I think Wireshark has more important things to do with the SMB2 and working on the stuff that Microsoft is releasing. But yes, hopefully once we get this in the docs, we can get this in. And so here's an example. Let me show you connecting to temp-enc. And as you can see, it connects normally. But if I try and do anything, I get anti-status access denied. Because that's an encrypt-only share. There's nothing you can, everything is denied. So yeah, you can do the initial TCON, but you're frozen out from there. So if I do, I'm not going to show you the Wireshark trace for this because it's essentially the same, but if I do an E, it works. So that's done an encrypted setup. Oh, thank you. Okay, it didn't crash. Hooray! So let's go a small demo. We're actually probably going to run into lunch a little bit. Okay, thank you. 5 minutes. So the other things that 3.2 has that I worked on were the IPv6 conversion. That was a lot of... Essentially what happened was the federal government in the US mandated that all new software had to be IPv6 compliant, I think by the middle of this year, which means that a bunch of federal departments right now are scrambling around for waivers because nothing is IPv6 compliant, or at least many things aren't. But we needed to be. This is essentially just grunt work. It's kind of fun, but some of the issues were I had to make it work on IPv4 only machines. So there are ways to do this. You can essentially end up having lots of ifdefs all over the code that call the same thing twice. But the sane way to do it is even on systems with old libcs that don't support the new IPv6 cores, like get, add, or info, is essentially to re-implement all the IPv6 interfaces like get, add, or info as a layer that then just calls down to the old get host by name, get host by adder, whatever. So essentially I just re-implemented those calls inside a libre place and then changed all the Samba code. This is sort of one slide, but it actually took about as long as the P-string conversion. And then made the Samba code call all the protocol independent stuff. The thing that still uses IPv4 only is NMBD, but essentially if you're running in an IPv6 network, so you can run NMBD in an IPv6 if you have a network interface that has both IPv4 and IPv6, but NMBD will only bind to and respond to the IPv4 interface. If you have IPv6 only, there's simply no reason to ever run NMBD because it's not doing anything that would be useful for you. So I'm afraid, yeah, if you were interested in that, you already missed the talk. I wasn't sure whether he was going to be for or after me. But most modern Linux distros now will come out of the box with IPv6 turned on. I know Ubuntu does. One of the cool things was I really, to test it, because very few people actually have working connections to the IPv6 internet. So actually to test the code, I just set up link local addresses on my boxes and used link local for IPv6, which is kind of funny because you have to have the percent adapter name on the end of it. But I made that work. And the nice thing is, the thing I'm really proud about this code is I made it, got it all working on link local without any connections to the IPv6 internet. And I handed it over to David Holder, who does have lots of connections to the IPv6 internet, and it worked first time. So I was kind of... We're still cleaning up a very few issues around bind interfaces only, but that, we're going to clean that up for release. I fixed one issue here yesterday. Host allow and deny can also be IPv6, so that we refactored that code so that you can filter on both IPv4 and IPv6 addresses, and that still works. And yes, the bottom line is we can bid on US federal contracts. Woohoo! We're fully IPv6 enabled. So the other interesting thing, and I think Steve's talk is either conflicting with me or was the one before. So this again is something that currently Windows doesn't do. SMB2 is an attempt to fix this. Not having the ability to change a Windows client, we decided to do something a little more interesting for the Linux SIFS client, and also for the Apple and hopefully Solaris SIFS clients. NetBIOS over TCP frames, the spec, the RFC spec says the length field is 17 bits. But there's actually a 24-bit field and the other 7 bits are unused, so we used them. It's kind of a little bit naughty, I suppose. I mean, let's say had a large vendor done this, they would have been screamed at for violating standards. So I do feel somewhat guilty about it, because we are violating standards by doing this. But it's very useful. And it gives a frame size of 16 megs. So with SendFile and Steve's Linux client, he can ask for a 16 meg read. And that thing fills the pipes. And it goes very, very fast. Steve actually has the numbers of the tests he's done on this. But I think he was telling me he can saturate gigabit links with this, which is quite nice. Now, the other problem was read is easy. Samba internally works with 128K buffers. How do we do a write of 16 meg? How do we accept an incoming 16 meg? Well, this is where things got a little useful, because Isilon, who's a Samba vendor, had a patch in their FreeBSD kernel that does receive file, which is the inverse of send file. Send file takes data from the buffer cache, flips it without going through user space into the TCP. Into the TCP buffer space. Well, SendFile that they added to FreeBSD does the reverse. It takes incoming data from the TCP buffer space, flips it into the buffer cache if you tell the kernel where to put it. So they had actually changed every single write call in Samba. They'd done an amazing job, but it was a very intrusive patch. It changed every write path, all of the all of the right code. And it touched more places than I really wanted to. So, I mean, to be honest, the write call that everybody uses, nobody uses any of the old write calls. So the only write call that matters is SMB writex. So what I did was I changed the initial packet processing of Samba to read essentially enough of the header for me to recognize that this is a writex in an incoming writex call, and leaves the rest of the data in the TCP buffer cache. And then it goes down the normal write code paths, pretending that it has the full data, which it doesn't. Obviously, this doesn't work with signing and encryption. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. So, all right, we're into lunch. If anyone is really hungry and wants to get the cake before it disappears, but yeah, feel free to leave. I'm nearly finished. I leave the data in the buffer cache. I lied internally to Samba. I claim that I've got the data and it's all in the buffer. So this doesn't work with encryption or signing, I must confess. But for non-encrypted or signed connections, it works well. And then we have a new VFS call, receive file, which basically says, here's a TCP socket, suck up n amount of bytes and plonk it into the buffer cache. At offset, on this file descriptor at this offset. And so if you've got receive file, and actually now Linux has receive file, they call it splice, which is what they built send file on top of, but Linux has this. It'll basically do a zero copy flip of the data from the TCP buffer into the file system buffer cache. And it's very fast. I don't have any real numbers on it yet. Once I get them, I should be able to come up with some nice performance tests. But remember, this is only going to work with... Well, actually, this works even with Windows clients if it's a small, because they tend to use 64K buffers. But for real performance, you can do this with 16 meg buffers. And so Steve uses the SIFS client to do this, to do some sort of real-time video streaming writes from the Linux SIFS client. It's very, very fast. It turns out that even without receive file, because the Linux I was developing it on had splice that worked as a send file but not as a receive file. Even without receive file, it works because internally I have a fake routine that basically allocates 128K and uses that as a staging area to read and write and read and write until I'm finished. And it turns out that if you do that, there are some efficiencies that Steve's client gets by being able to basically just do one single humongous write of 16 megs that his client code gets much, much more efficient. As I said, strangely enough, the Linux SIFS client goes fast when it's doing this, even without kernel support on the server side. So there's some efficiency in the TCP buffering that I think the SIFS client is getting there. We need to do some more research into exactly why this is. The other thing I've added for this is in the libSMB client and SMB client code. So previously, we had an internal staging buffer. And so somebody, Nautilus, would call down and say, write file, and basically, you know, we would copy the data into an internal buffer and then copy it again onto the wire. And I think we had two mem copies. I don't know where the second one was. It was either one or two. Anyway, I eliminated one of them. So I don't know whether you've noticed, if you ever do drag and drop from Nautilus onto an SMB share, it sucks. The write performance is very poor. The write performance now is significantly improved because we're basically doing less copies. And as I said, the issue with it is if you've got encrypted SMB or SMB signed connections, we can't do this because you have to assemble the buffer completely in memory in order to sign the packet. And this, again, is only turned on when you do a QFS info with a Unix extension level, and it tells you, hey, I can do large SMB reads and writes. You know, I can use the cheating frame size. So that's it. So just in time for lunch. So any other questions or new stuff for 3.2? We just have to finish it now and get it out there.
No questions at all?
I think people beat me up enough during the talk. So
thank you very much. As I said, we will have a lunch break now. The next talk will start at 1:30, so please be back a little bit earlier. Enjoy your lunch.